From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, how Tegan and Sarah Quinn became the songwriting and performing duo known as Tegan and Sarah. They're identical twins.
Tegan stole all our self-confidence in the womb.
She just siphoned it. She got all the food and I got all the confidence.
Their new memoir is about their high school years, a turning point in their lives when they started making music and started falling in love with girls. After high school, when they began recording albums and touring, being queer identical twins led to some strange questions from the media.
People would ask us if we were incestuous, like on the radio.
Oh, you like girls, therefore you must love each other.
We must love each other and sleep with each other. Uh-huh. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And David Bianculli reviews a new CBS show from the creators of The Good Wife called Evil. That's on Fresh Air. My guests, Tegan and Sarah, are twins and musical collaborators, singer-songwriters who have won awards for their music and for their advocacy of LGBTQ issues. They've won 3 Juno Awards, the Canadian equivalent of the Grammys, and they've received a Grammy nomination. They were honored by the New York Civil Liberties Union. Their album Heartthrob was on our rock critic Ken Tucker's top 10 list in 2013. Tegan and Sarah have written a new memoir called High School about their lives when they were in high school. It was a tumultuous period when they each started falling in love with girls and when they started writing and recording songs. There was a lot of tension between the twins as they tried to create separate identities while also collaborating on music. Their memoir ends in 1998 when they turned 18 and signed a contract with PolyGram Records. Tegan and Sarah have released a new CD that's a companion to their memoir. It's called Hey, I'm Just Like You, and it features songs they wrote as teenagers. They describe it as a record they never could have made as teenagers, full of songs they never could have written as adults. Let's start with a song from the new album. It's called I'll Be Back.
Sit and watch my TV set. What is on will make it better. We'll make it better. I want to call and ask what's up. Go to dial, but then I stop.
Tegan, Sarah, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you on the show.
We're so delighted to be here, Terry. Thank you so much.
Were you afraid about going back and, you know, revisiting songs that you wrote as teenagers and then recording them? When I look at things I wrote when I was in high school, I actually have some things I wrote when I was in high school. I have them deeply hidden in boxes, in closets, and there are so many things on top of those boxes I can't possibly ever get to it. I'm not quite ready to burn it, but God forbid I should ever actually look at it. So what was it like for you to revisit early songs?
When we were writing the memoir, Tegan was sort of the initiator in finding some of our archival materials, like the audio recordings, the VHS tapes that we had from high school of ourselves hanging out with friends in that school. I was more reluctant, and I think my sort of takeaway from both the memoir and the album and that general time period is that I have a lot more self-loathing, insecurity, and shame than Tegan does, and
a lot more.
And I have the therapy bills to prove it, but. Yeah, I was really reluctant to listen to the songs from high school, and Tegan had to do quite a hunt to find them. We hadn't kept our original demo tapes, and so she ended up sort of scrambling around asking friends and friends of friends, and when she did eventually find them, she had them digitized and sent me the audio, like MP3s, and I avoided listening to them. I think I share a sort of social similarity or anxiety that a lot of us have. I didn't want to look back at the reality. I preferred my memories, and I preferred editing my memories, and I don't know, I was afraid that I would hear something. I thought I would hear something that I would be embarrassed by or ashamed of. And the truth is that when I finally did listen, I was struck by the joy in our voices and our early recordings. And I actually felt a lot of grief in a way, because I think that the narrative or that insecurity that I sort of had been carrying around with me was not real. You know, we were great. And we were writing these really sophisticated, adventurous songs as teenagers. And that was why we ended up signing a record deal as teenagers and starting our career. And I don't know why I allowed myself to believe that there wasn't something of value for us to, you know, write about or think about or listen to. And those early songs, for me, at least with my 38-year-old ears, I just thought, oh my God, this music is, there's just something really valuable about it. And I wanted people to hear it.
Tegan, were you as afraid to look back as Sarah was?
I was not, Terry. I think, yeah, as Sarah said, I think we had really...
Tegan stole all our self-confidence in the womb.
She just... I siphoned it. She got all the food and I got all the confidence. I think, yeah, I think my memory of high school, my memory of that time has been less eroded, you know, by the sort of shared, you know, narrative that I think all of us have, which is, you know, when people look back, they do exactly as you've just done, which is to say, oh, I wouldn't dare look at what I wrote or what I created when I was in high school. And I think for me, I hadn't looked. So obviously some part of me didn't think it was valuable. But I think I think that I had more confidence and maybe I had a little more memory around the music itself. And I'm definitely self-conscious about some of what I created, but some of what Sarah created from that time has stuck with me the last 20 years. I think Sarah had developed a sense of songwriting and had already established herself as a very specific kind of songwriter at that age, and it's something she's kept consistent through the last 20 years. I think Sarah's always been spectacular at saying a lot with very little, and I think she was able to do that even as a teenager. Her first songs had profound meaning to me at that time.
So what you're saying is I peaked. I peaked in high school.
Well, you've sustained a certain... you hit the summit and you've sustained. And I think for me, most of my cringing was over maybe some more of my music than hers. And the joy and the enthusiasm I felt listening to Sarah's material is what really inspired me to push us to finish the book and then immediately record these songs for a new record.
So the book is called High School, and it's about when you were in high school. And that's a difficult time for most people. And during high school, it's one of the periods of your life, of everybody's life, I think, when you're trying to figure out who are you, how do you fit in with other people, and how do you differentiate yourselves from mm-hmm. other people. That's kind of standard high school things. Did being twins make it more complicated to figure out not only where you fit in, but how to differentiate yourself, not only from other people, but from each other?
I think that's one of the most significant, you know, through lines for us in our life, not just in high school, but the experience of being twins. We didn't have other siblings at the time. So, you know, our whole experience from birth until today has always been, okay, we are sisters and we share a face and we share a birthday. We share a sort of common interest or common place in the world. And in some ways, there was power in being twins. And then there was also, in some cases, like a terrible inconvenience. And sometimes it was, you know, like there was this this invasion of privacy. Sometimes it was physical. Since we were little kids, I mean, I always like to say that in some ways we were famous since we were born. I mean, my mom and dad would separate us at the mall, and one would take one of us and the other would take the other, because, you know, people would come up and touch us at the mall and talk to us and look at us. And
because you were so identical?
Because we were so identical, and we were adorable, Terry. I mean, we were very cute.
No doubt.
But it wasn't just that we looked the same. I mean, but, you know, I seriously think that in some ways, even as small children, we understood that there was a way to use our twinness, like, the you know for good, and then there was ways that it was really inconvenient, and I think it caused, you know, at least I know for myself, more so than Tegan, I've talked about it as almost like a burden in some ways, the origin of my insecurity. I never knew if people really liked me. I always thought, oh God, do they only like me because I'm part of this thing, this identity.
And I was
sister.
Like grabbing Sarah and shoving her out in front of new people and being like, and I'm a twin.
Yes, I did feel Tegan exploited us sometimes, but in some ways it really made us uniquely qualified to be musicians and to be public people. And you know, in high school, I remember it was particularly complicated because I had started to, I mean, my sort of questioning of my identity and sexuality started in elementary school. And I never, of course, shared this with Tegan or spoke about it with her. I was really ashamed. I was really scared about what I sort of started to kind of understand about myself. And I remember in high school, that was just like the breaking point. I had started to have romantic sexual relationships with girls in secret. And Tegan scared me because I knew she understood what was probably happening with me. And I was afraid because I think I knew that that was going to happen to her too, that she was going to be gay. And then there was no way for me to control how to, like, I couldn't protect myself because it wasn't just me who was gay. It was Tegan who was gay also. And I remember feeling a sort of resentment and fear about the fact that there was two gay people to protect, not just one.
Well, Tegan, you write in the book about how when Sarah had her first girlfriend, who had been your best friend, all three of you had been best friends, and you felt like Sarah stole your best friend from you, and you were like bereft. And it took you a while, I think, to figure out that, well, they were girlfriend and girlfriend, too. It wasn't just best friend. And so what was your reaction when you not only felt excluded, you knew that they had something very special that went beyond just friendship?
It's interesting because one of the things that made me want to write the book was just how different Sarah and I's experience was growing up and coming out. And that's one of the big things that I felt writing the book was just how profound it was to read Sarah's experience and see how different it was from what I remembered and also what I felt. And when Sarah and Naomi is her name in the book, but when Sarah and Naomi get together, I don't know that's happening, but I am sort of shoved out of this three-person best friendship. So it was very, very distressing for me. And I was sort of coming out of a darker period. For me, middle school was really hard. Grade 9 was really tough. I had terrible acne and was very, I would say now with using my adult language, I was definitely depressed, but I didn't know that I was depressed. And so when this happened, when Sarah and Naomi got together, I was very confused and I sort of had been coming out of this darkness and Naomi was a big part of that. So I felt really left out. But then when I read Sarah's side of the book, it was so sad to me that Sarah had seen my reaction was to be angry and to be, you know, pressed against their door being like, let me in. why am I sleeping in the guest bedroom now? And for Sarah, my anger and insistence on being around was homophobia. So for her, she felt like I did know and that I was, you know, disgusted or angry or ashamed of her. And that was really hard to read. But I think it was really important for me to read and to understand how that shift that had happened for Sarah, that she just assumed I knew and that some of her anger and her frustration was fear. You know, it was her own homophobia. And, you know, then near the end of the book, of course, I have a relationship with my best friend and I find Sarah to be cruel to us, you know, constantly calling me gay in front of her and teasing us and not giving us space. And I didn't understand because by that point, of course, I understood that Sarah had been having this relationship. And so for me, it felt just so unfair that she wouldn't let me have this experience. And so again, reading the book, it was like, oh, she was afraid. She was afraid. She felt I was exposing us, me and Sarah. She was, she felt I was uncovering this horrible shame that she had, which for me wasn't a horrible shame. I was thrilled when I figured out that I was gay. It was like, you know, clicking the last piece of the Rubik's Cube into place. I finally understood myself. And so we had just these profoundly different experiences.
Do you remember the first time you spoke to each other about being gay?
It's today, Carrie. I'll tell you what this book and this record has done. It's made us have to talk about our sexuality in a way that we pretty much never have.
I don't think we ever, I came out before Tegan. I mean, I was sort of dragged out by my mom. When I was 18, I was having another fairly significant relationship with another girl, and my mom, I think she just was at the end of her rope. She knew.
She was like, all right.
She was like, okay. You're like, how long is this going to go on? And I didn't have one single conversation with Tegan. Even after I had had the conversation with my mother and then had the conversation with my dad and my stepdad and other relatives, friends, whatever, Tegan and I, there was just always such a discomfort for me in discussing it. And I think in some ways that was those unresolved issues around like experiencing Tegan's invasion of my privacy when I first began dating girls as sort of like her you know, maybe shaming me or making me feel like I was doing something bad. And I think I had sort of protected myself from her because I was afraid of her in some ways. And I think also I felt betrayed by her when I was coming out in, you know, I write about this a bit in the book, at the end of the book, but my coming out was very challenging with my mom. And she had been such a cool parent, very open-minded, went back to university and college as an adult, had brought ideas like racial justice and social justice. And like, you know, like we talked about gay people. Like she was a really advanced, forward-thinking feminist woman. And yet when I came out, we struggled. And she was, she didn't handle it the way that I would have imagined she was going to handle it, knowing that she was so open-minded and had this kind of like, gay people are fine, there's nothing wrong with being gay. And then I came out and she was really mad. She was really disappointed that I hadn't told her, and we really struggled and we had a very difficult time. And I felt mad at Tegan for not supporting me.
Yeah, I couldn't tell reading the book whether she was mad at you for lying to her, because she had asked you mm-hmm. if you liked girls and you kept denying it. Mm-hmm. And if she was mad at you, well, if she was mad at you for having lied to her, and upset because she knew mm-hmm. things might be harder for you because you were a lesbian, or whether she was just upset that you were a lesbian, you know?
I think it was a lot of things. I think it was that I had lied to her. I think that there was an angry reaction, like perhaps she realized, oh, I could have been supporting my kid differently, and maybe there was a guilt or a regret in the way that she responded. You know, she and I obviously now have repaired that part of us that was sort of damaged by that, my coming out. But, you know, she would probably tell you today that a big part of her anger was that she was mad that I didn't tell her, that I had lied to her, that she had done the good parent thing and sit down and say, hey, I think you might be having feelings for girls. You can tell me. And I was constantly saying no. And I think, you know, what I've said this to her now as an adult many times, and I know it's really hard to forgive herself for the way that she treated that experience at the time. But, you know, when she would say to me, I just don't understand why you wouldn't tell me, what did I do wrong? What could I have done differently? And I think what's important for me to tell other parents and other people is that I couldn't tell anyone because I couldn't even admit it to myself. Mm-hmm. I did not use the language I'm gay or I'm anything. I was utterly terrified to define myself using those words. And so even when my mom was coming to my room and saying, hey, you can trust me, I'm on your side, if you're doing this, I want you to tell me, that would have required me having a first conversation with myself. And I just was, you know, I was taking drugs, drinking, denying. I was so afraid. I was running in the opposite direction from the truth. And so, you know, my coming out was painful because I sort of had to, I had to come out to a lot of people, including myself at that time, even though I had almost 4 years of relationships with women. And in some ways, Tegan, again, because I think I knew Tegan was about to have her own coming out. Again, I was afraid of her. I was, in some ways, I was taking on the emotional labor of coming out for both of us. And I resented her because I knew she was going to have it way easier. And she did. When she came out, it was easier.
do you agree that you had it easier?
Yes, I do agree that I had it easier. My coming out happened almost a year later, and I also didn't really use the words. You know, I just showed up with what was obviously my girlfriend, and everyone in my life was like, okay, so you're also gay. And my mom, 3 months after dating this woman, I said I was going to move to Vancouver and move in with her, and my mom flew to Vancouver and bought me a couch and a pot set, and I felt Sarah's very, very, very palpable resentment at the way that went down. You know, Sarah took the initial blast for sure.
My guests are the musical duo Tegan and Sarah. They're identical twins. Their new memoir is called High School. Their new CD comes out Friday. After a break, they'll tell us about going on tour with Neil Young when they were 20 and what it was like to be queer identical twins in the music world in the late 1990s. And David Bianculli will review Evil, a new show from CBS, which he says is worth checking out. Here's a song by Tegan and Sarah from their 2013 album, Heartthrob. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With the Capital One Saver Card, you can earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment. That means 4% on milkshakes with the kids and 4% on music with your pals. You'll also earn 2% cash back at grocery stores and 1% on all other purchases. Now when you go out, you cash in. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Terms apply.
Let's get back to my interview with Tegan and Sarah, the songwriting and singing duo who are also identical twins. They've won awards for their music and for their advocacy of LGBTQ issues. Their new memoir, High School, is about their teenage years when they started writing songs and performing and when they started falling in love with girls. They also have a new CD called Hey, I'm Just Like You, featuring new recordings of songs they wrote in their teens. They just celebrated their 39th birthdays. So let's continue our conversation. Why don't we start with a song from the new album? The album's called Hey, I'm Just Like You, but the song I want to play is a song that's about lying. And I know, like, you had to lie to your mother to not tell her that you were lesbians. You had to lie about drugs when she asked you about doing drugs. You had to cover up your sexual identities from a lot of people who you knew. So tell us about this song, which is about lying. It's called Don't Believe the Things I Tell You.
So when Tegan and I were 15, we discovered a guitar. Our stepdad had like an acoustic kind of stuck away under the stairs in the basement. And we started writing songs. It was a very sort of intuitive process. You know, we had played music, we'd taken piano lessons, but we had always played classical music. And as soon as we picked out the guitar, we actually just started writing our own music. And one of the first fully formed songs was Don't Believe the Things They Tell You, They Lie. And when we discovered these old demos, this song, it was just, as soon as I heard the first, like the opening chords, it was just permanently in my, like I knew exactly what the song was. It was just such a hooky little, like a pop song, but it was, you know, very like crunchy electric guitar, very trashy singing. Lyrics were somewhat incoherent. There were certain lines that stuck out, but this chorus would come up like, don't believe the things they tell you, they lie. And I just remember the power of singing that when I was 15 years old. And I think, you know, Tegan and I have talked about this. We really struggled with the fact that we'd been these really good kids, sweet kids, and we hit 14, 15, and we started lying. Like, we just started lying to everybody, lying to ourselves, lying to each other, lying to our mother, lying to the teachers. We were skipping classes. And I think we really were wrestling with this idea that we were now bad, that we were bad kids and that we were disappointing people. And I love the song. We've obviously added a little bit of an adult voice in the current version that we have out coming out on our album. But I still love that kind of like that idea of being, wrestling with this kind of like both good and bad personas within yourself.
Okay, so let's hear it. And this is Don't Believe the Things They Tell You from Tegan and Sarah's new album, Hey, I'm Just Like You, which is about to come out.
The things I've almost told you, all the things I've thought about you, it takes all my strength to face you, to hold still. And when you give me your attention, things get lost in translation. Again, tell you I don't love you at all, but I do love you. I don't wanna be a liar, but I do it every day. I don't wanna be so tired, but I can't sleep anyway. Don't believe the things they tell you, they lie.
So that's a track from Tegan and Sarah's forthcoming album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. It comes out on September 27th. So when you started writing songs, how much of it was you writing individually and how much of it was collaborating at the same time?
Right from the beginning, we've always written separately. But I think in high school, we needed each other more. You know, we would write and then you know, or I would write a song and then I would go next door to Sarah's bedroom because I needed her to operate the tape deck, you know, to help me record the song. We were obsessed with listening to ourselves. So right from the first song we ever recorded, which was called Tegan Didn't Go to School Today, you can hear the others, whoever's singing is the person who wrote the song, but you can hear the other's voice in the background trying to shout out, you know, vocal lines or adding extra lyrics. And almost right away we started to weave our voices together. That was something that we had an instinct to do right away. I wouldn't call it harmonizing initially, but there was definitely a lot of collaboration like that. And then about maybe 6 months after we started writing songs, we had our 16th birthday and our mom got us an electric guitar. And that's when you can hear us really start to take shape, like the sound starts to take shape because there's two guitars, there's two different vocals happening. But the bulk of our songwriting has always been that one of us writes the song and then the other just kind of provides an editing or a background vocal or something.
But they're credited to both of you.
Always, yeah. Sarah doesn't know this because she's never bothered to look, but I'm actually, as the publisher, I get 60%.
You do not.
She doesn't understand. But no, we're 50-50 on everything. We share the work, you know. I think we never saw it as my song or Sarah's song. I think we do our music to sort of come from both of us in a way.
So you cited a song called Tegan Didn't Go to School Today. That was the first song, Sarah, that you wrote. And it's the lyric, or part of the lyric anyways, is quoted in the book. And as I read the lyric, I thought, I need to hear how that sounds. So would you?
Oh, yeah, sure. It went, Tegan didn't go to school today, left me all alone to play. Took her purple shoes when she went back to bed. I could have kicked her in the head. Where's Tegan? Where's Tegan? That's basically how it went.
And was that an autobiographical song, like torn from your life stories?
It was. Tegan had these incredible, we would do one annual shopping trip for new back to school clothes, and it was so stressful because it was like you only got one shot, you know, for the whole year. This was going to be your look. And
oh God, I remember shopping trips like that.
It's so stressful. I mean, what a kids think they're anxious now. Try shopping once a year. Stressful. Anyways, my mom took us out, and I remember Tegan, this would happen a lot with us as twins. We didn't want the same thing. You know, like people will always say, did your parents dress you the same? Like,
oh yeah.
We did not want to dress the same. Occasionally we would become so like deeply connected to a piece of thing, like our snowsuits were the same because I think we just found the snowsuit we wanted and we were like, we have to have this. But Tegan had these great skate shoes, like, you know, like purple etnies, and man, did I was just deeply jealous of them. They were fantastic. And I remember we would always get mad at each other when Tegan would get sick and I would have to go to school alone. I really felt angry with her. But the one sort of saving grace on this particular occasion that I wrote about in the song, she did loan me her shoes, her purple etnies. And I wrote a whole song about it. I mean, it started as a joke, but truly it did launch our songwriting.
Let's take another short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tegan and Sarah, the identical twins, songwriting and singing duo who have a new book, a new memoir called High School, about their high school years, and they also have a new companion album that features songs that they wrote during the period covered by the book when they were in high school. And the album is called Hey, I'm Just Like You. So we'll be right back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor OnStar. No one likes to be alone when the unexpected happens. If the unexpected is a crash in an OnStar-equipped vehicle, an OnStar advisor is ready to help. With automatic crash response, your vehicle can automatically connect to an emergency certified advisor. OnStar, be safe out there. Certified by International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, OnStar links to emergency services. Not all vehicles may transmit all crash data. See OnStar.com for details and limitations.
You know Jonathan Van Ness as a fabulous cast member of Netflix's Queer Eye. But as a kid,
I was basically just like a geode-obsessed, stamp-collecting, rock-collecting, obsessed with gymnastics.
Jonathan Van Ness on his transformation and his new book. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Tegan and Sarah, and they're songwriters and singers and musicians. They've been performing together since high school and been making albums for about 20 years. And now they have a new memoir called High School about their high school years, which was a turning point for them in terms of understanding their sexual orientations, understanding that they really wanted to make music. So they have a new memoir called High School and a new companion album called Hey, I'm Just Like You, which is songs that they wrote while they were in high school, but performed the way they perform now. So your aunt suggested that you enter a competition at an area college, and the winner of the music competition was going to get hours of time in a recording studio and the possibility of a contract afterwards. So you entered the contest. You were the youngest ones in the contest. You won. You were 16 at the time,
I think? 17.
17, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then by the time you were 18, as soon as you became legal and could sign a contract, you signed a contract with PolyGram. And so another big turning point in your lives. I think, judging from your book, it was also a big turning point in differentiating yourselves more from each other. And Tegan, something that you say in the book, you say, a lifetime of calibrating myself alongside Sarah ended abruptly. And this was about the same time period. So what ended it, and in what sense did you feel you were always calibrating your life alongside Sarah's?
Well, we always joke that when you meet twins, there's always one that really wants to be in the twin ship, and then there's the one that's always trying to escape, and Sarah's always trying to escape. And I think that, you know, starting with the fracture that happened when her and Naomi got together, I had sort of been clinging to Sarah for dear life. I'd always really relied on her. I'd always been really proud of the fact that we were twins. And when we started making music, it was like, great, Sarah and I will be together forever now, making music together. And as Sarah, you know, struggled more and more with her identity and we got closer to the end of high school, it was like she was withholding that option from me. That's what it felt like at times. You know, she was very, very much in love with someone and that person was going to go out to Toronto. And Sarah talked about maybe going with her. And my mom had been pushing us to enroll in university and neither of us had wanted to. And then the second we won that competition, my mom said, all right, kind of gave us her blessing to spend a year focused on music. And immediately Sarah started talking about going to university. And I felt like she was withholding our dream from me. But in a way, we became very angry and at odds with one another. But also, I started to just kind of climb out of this prison that I had sort of put us in together. And I realized, well, if Sarah doesn't want that, then I'm going to go get it. And I'm going to be this. You know, I cut all my hair off. I started to speak openly about moving away after school. I was going to move to Vancouver. I was going to sign a record deal. I was going to do all these things. I had uncovered who I was. And I started to just see myself as an individual, see myself as my own person, not in a relationship with Sarah, like as sisters anymore or in a band, which of course was all crap because actually deep down inside, I was desperate for Sarah to agree to do this and I needed her and I knew I needed her, but I just thought, well, I'm going to push through and I'm going to make this happen anyway. And, you know, thankfully Sarah agreed to sign the deal and move to Vancouver and be in a band.
Still thinking about going back to university now.
At what point did you decide to come out publicly? And how did you decide to do it?
We never did. We just really looked gay. And I just don't think anyone, like there was not, I mean, there was a handful of interviews we did in high school where we were 17-year-old high school students who just won a competition. You know, the questions weren't very probing. I mean, it was very like, what do your boyfriends think? You know, that sort of thing. I mean, I can remember very distinctly thinking, okay, I can't do this. I can't lie. I can't pretend that these songs I'm writing that are obviously love songs are about boys. Like, I really remember feeling that way. And again, it wasn't something Tegan and I discussed. But when we got out of high school, we took the long road and we ended up signing with Neil Young. And he had a little label called Vapor Records. And it was perfect for us at the time. There was a lot of discussion around, you will find your voices, you will tour the world, you will cut your teeth on big stages and little stages, you'll take the Greyhound, you will learn how to be musicians, you will build a career, and you will write your best music in your 30s and 40s. Take your time. And I remember being really nervous but excited about the opportunity. And one of the first things that happened was someone from the record label called and said, we have a couple of big pieces of news for you. One, Neil Young is going to take you on tour. We were 20 years old. and you're going to tour all across the U.S. with him opening his show. And we're also going to get you guys a publicist, and you're going to start doing press. And I remember one of the first rounds of press we did was with gay press. And I remember them saying, like, whatever it was at the time, like, I don't know if it was Out Magazine, but it was like, this
is... it was a magazine called Lesbian News.
Lesbian News. So pretty obvious.
And they put us on the cover.
And I remember... saying Tegan's like, it was actually just called You're Gay and We Have Gay Magazine for you to do. But so I remember calling, we had like a conference call with the label, and I remember being really nervous, and I remember saying,
which the label was
three people.
One was Neil Young's manager, yeah, Elliot Roberts.
Yes. And I remember, so we're on the phone with a couple of people from the label and Elliot Roberts, Neil Young's manager, and I remember having to work myself up to it, but I said, is it okay if we do this gay press? And they were like, of course. And we were like, is it okay that we're gay? Can we talk about our sexuality? And like, you know, I remember Elliot saying, like, are you gay? And we were like, yes. And he was like, then you can talk about it. And we were like, what if it hurts our career? And he was like, what career? Like, you don't have a career yet. There's nothing to hurt. And I remember feeling such tremendous relief that they were accepting us as we were.
I also want to point out that this is, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, talking about being queer or gay was like hot potato.
Oh, yeah.
You'd lob that at someone and they would just be like so ready to get it out of their hands.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
like, you take it, you take
yeah,
it.
Yeah, nobody really, really wanted to dive in, as Sarah said. It wasn't an era of deep probing from journalists. It was very much, you're twins, you're from Canada, Neil Young signed you, end of interview, next interview, you're twins, you're from Canada, Neil Young signed you. And I think we were glad for the space to find our language, you know?
Yeah.
So it must have been great to tour with Neil Young.
It's so funny because it was an amazing experience, and we were absolutely thrilled, but we were 19. So
20.
You know, sorry, we were 20. So we cared. You know, career-wise, we understood the significance of what was being offered. The direct support on the tour was the Pretenders. I mean, we were living some sort of dream, and we knew it. But we were also, you know, opening. You know, people are getting their seats with beer and nachos.
It's telling like us to take our shirts
older
off.
Guys, yeah, like oh, yelling nice. Free bird. And, you know, and then they'd put us in a golf cart after we played to a nearly empty house and make us play in the beer gardens. And then we'd get in the van to drive 15 hours to chase the tour. And it was hard. Sarah and I were... you know, just had moved to Vancouver. We were both in new relationships. I think we were really lonely. You know, there was no Wi-Fi, no internet. No one wanted to hear about this, by the way. Everyone would cut us off and be like, but it was amazing, right? You were having the time of your lives. And I'm like, I don't know. We took three Polaroids. We kind of looked depressed. But we were thrilled. I mean, We learned a lot.
We learned a lot.
And we learned how to run a business, and we learned how to be good every night, and we learned to show up and have a good attitude, and we learned to be grateful.
We got really good at dealing with catcalling. Like, you know, I mean, this
yeah,
is
we acquired a lot of skills.
We did. Like, I mean, we laugh about it. There was trauma involved. I don't want to downplay what it was like to have like 60-year-old men tell us to take our shirts off. We were 20 years old. I mean, it was awful. But on the other hand, it did give us this kind of clever, quick wit that we had to employ on stage. And I think it made people like us and root for us. And I'm not saying that I'm glad it happened, or I mean, of course, I wish that the tour had felt different in terms of like the way that the audience had responded to us. But on the other hand, I can't deny that we did learn from
well, after that tour, we also did a cross-Canadian tour of small clubs, and they were sold out. And I'll tell you, it made me appreciate our audience, and I also appreciate that no matter if there's 50 people in the audience or 100, if they're there for you, it feels extraordinary. And I think we learned that lesson very quickly, that
we wanted our own audience.
We wanted our own audience, yeah. And we would appreciate them and work hard to keep them.
Tegan and Sarah, thank you. Oh, saying Tegan and Sarah reminds me, when you started performing, you were Sarah and Tegan. How did you become Tegan and Sarah?
Well, we changed the name only because we had a manager at the time, very short-lived, but he... pointed,
like, he didn't die.
No. He only managed us for like 8 months, but he gave us one good piece of advice during that time. And that was, he said, when people say Sarah and Tegan, it all blends together into one word and they don't know what you're saying. But if you say Tegan and Sarah, you have to enunciate. So I think you should switch your names around. So we did.
Oh, okay.
That's it. I know. It's not very exciting.
Secret to your success.
No.
Yeah.
All right. Tegan and Sarah, thank you so much. It was really such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tegan and Sarah's new memoir is called High School. Their new CD, featuring new recordings of songs they wrote as teenagers, is called Hey, I'm Just Like You. It will be released Friday. After a break, our TV critic David Bianculli will review a new CBS show from the creators of The Good Wife. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Panera Bread. Ask yourself, when was the last time you had a meal that was fresh and filling? Panera's new warm grain bowls are full of flavorful ingredients like hearty quinoa, spicy salsa verde, and creamy avocado. Full of flavors, textures, and colors. Full of good, so you'll be full of good too. Try a new Baja or Mediterranean warm grain bowl. Warm grain bowls full of good. Now available for delivery. Panera. Food as it should be.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
The fall TV season starts officially the day after the Primetime Emmy Awards, which this year means the broadcast networks begin unveiling their new shows tonight. Our TV critic David Bianculli says the whole fall season concept isn't what it used to be, but this year there's at least one new series from the broadcast networks worth sampling from the start. It's from CBS, and it's called Evil. It premieres Thursday. Here's David's review.
Back in the old days of TV, before either streaming or cable television, the broadcast networks were king, enjoying a virtual monopoly. And each fall, CBS, NBC, and ABC would roll out their new shows at the same time in order to attract the most viewers for their automotive advertisers, who in turn were rolling out their new fall models. It's a TV tradition that has persisted, even though neither Detroit nor the networks are nearly as dominant as they used to be. These days, the best new TV shows tend to come from cable or streaming sites, not the broadcast networks. Shows like AMC's Better Call Saul, FX's Fargo and Legion, Netflix's Mindhunter. In today's TV drama, this is where most of the action is. In fact, the last great TV drama to emerge from a commercial broadcast network was CBS's The Good Wife. And the creators of that series, Robert and Michelle King, emigrated to that network's sister streaming site, CBS All Access, to produce a worthy spinoff, The Good Fight. But this season, the Kings are back on CBS, and back with a show that's as smart as The Good Wife, only scarier. The show is called Evil, and premieres Thursday. It stars Katja Herbers, a Dutch actress who played the daughter of Ed Harris's Man in Black on HBO's Westworld. In Evil, she plays Kristen Bouchard, a single mom with four daughters who works as a forensic psychologist for the New York District Attorney's Office. Her job is to assess whether accused murderers are sane enough to stand trial, which has her, like the FBI profilers of Mindhunter, talking to serial killers in an effort to better understand them. As in this early scene, when she questions a defendant named Orson, charged with several brutal murders.
I blacked out. I already said. Do you think I'm lying?
I think there are three families dead. I think you're facing life without the possibility of parole. I think if you wanted to help me, you could take a short test.
To see if I'm lying?
These are 567 true or false statements. You answer as honestly as you can.
Sure. Not going anywhere.
True or false? I like mechanics magazines.
Are you serious? False.
I think I'd enjoy working as a librarian.
False.
I have diarrhea once or more a month.
False, but thanks for asking.
I like the sound of a woman screaming. Orson?
Kristen's life changes significantly when Orson's case introduces her to David Acosta. He's portrayed by Mike Coulter, who played Luke Cage in Marvel's Netflix TV series. And here, he's playing a role that's a lot less physical than metaphysical. David is a former priest in training whose job is to travel around the world investigating various claims involving demonic possession, alleged miracles, and other phenomena that are not easily explained. Before long, David offers Kristen to join him. And with four kids to raise, she's tempted by any offer that might help pay the bills.
Just to be upfront with you, Mr.
Acosta.
Acosta, I don't believe in all that devils and possession.
That's okay. See, the problem with my job is that possession looks a lot like insanity, and insanity looks a lot like possession. I need someone to help me distinguish between the two.
You don't care that I don't believe?
I do not.
How much do you pay?
This establishes David and Kristen as a church-appointed Mulder and Scully with the identical X-Files dynamic. She's a skeptic, he's more open-minded, yet they're willing to learn from one another. Robert and Michelle King, who created this series, have a similar dynamic tension, and Evil reflects their strengths as TV writers and producers. As with The Good Wife, the actors are gifted, the plots are smart, and the characters are refreshingly human, nuanced, and unpredictable. Even the demonic and sinister elements of this Evil series will surprise you. The supernatural spirits being investigated have almost comically common names like George and Roy, and they have attitude. It's like being haunted by someone who's part devil and part snarky David Spade. It's very unsettling, and somehow even creepier. And speaking of creepier, late in the premiere episode, Michael Emerson from Lost shows up, playing a guy so conniving and frightening, he's like a mixture of Machiavelli and Charles Manson. He may be the real recurring villain of this new series, but then again, so could the internet, because the Kings are fascinated with modern media and its impact as well. Whatever else ends up emerging or failing to from the new crop of fall shows from the broadcast networks, one thing is clear from the start. This season, at least on CBS, Evil is good.
David Bianculli is the editor of the website TV Worth Watching. His latest book is The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Ta-Nehisi Coates. After writing three nonfiction books dealing with race and identity, and writing new Black Panther comics for Marvel, and writing a much-talked-about article about reparations, he's written his first novel. Set in slave times, it reimagines leaders of the Underground Railroad as having a magical power to help people out of slavery. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.